This is Vicky Auld, recorded at the Marguerite Bay reunion in Bowness on Windermere by Chris Alden Lee on the 31st of October 2010. Vicky Auld.
It's Victoria Jane Auld. Date of birth 11/9/72 and place of birth Plymouth, Devon.
So you're how old now? 28?
38.
38. That was being polite, wasn't it?
Very.
What sort of background did he have? Did he have a private education, state school?
I did. I was very lucky. I had a private education in a boarding school. My dad was in the Navy, and so every couple of years we were moving away around the country and then internationally. So I think the best place for me at that stage was boarding school.
Where did you go?
A place in Torquay called Stoodley Knoll. It was a convent school.
Really?
Yes. I thought I was going to get out for sixth form, but I actually ended up staying for sixth year as well. So, yeah. It's a great place. Did a lot of sport and enjoyed myself and still in touch with all my friends from school now. So,
did you wind up at university?
I did, yeah.
Reading what?
Physics and astrophysics, which was
Why?
Tougher than I thought it was going to be.
What was your passion?
I think at that stage it was astronomy. I was very interested in space science at the time. And I think the physics side was a kind of natural progression into it at university. But through the course, I just decided that actually looking at the stars was probably more pleasurable than understanding the fairly difficult maths involved with space physics. So I ended up kind of getting more interested in the atmosphere, kind of coming back down to Earth and the impacts of the atmosphere on any of the...
So did you complete the degree?
I did, yeah.
And that was where was that?
That was at the University of Birmingham. Probably more play than hard work, I think, at that stage.
But so what was your degree in the end?
It was a 2-2 in physics and astrophysics.
Okay,
yeah,
all right. Yeah. What was your first brush or inkling, brush with the Antarctic, or inkling that some place called the Antarctic might exist?
It was at University at Birmingham, actually. I can't remember the name of the chap. He was a bass man, a biologist, and he came and gave a lecture, and I'd just seen a poster and thought, that looks pretty exciting, I'll go and have a look at that. Wasn't interested in biology particularly at the time, but the talk that he gave encompassed not just biology but all the other kind of sciences that were going on down there at the time. So I had a word with him after that talk, and I was like, you know, what could I do down there? And he's like, well, give it a couple of years, because they're not actually taking women down there for any kind of physics based work, so come back in a couple of years and see what we're doing.
So there were no, what year was this then?
That was 94, I think, yes, okay. 94. So I went and did a master's after that in atmospheric science, meteorology, effectively.
How did you feel when you heard about this organisation that didn't take women?
It was quite surprising, actually. I think I'd, you know, had a fairly lucky upbringing in the fact that I was thinking that I could do anything that I wanted to do in terms of career choice. And to then suddenly find out there were still careers that were closed off to women quite surprised me, but I don't think I thought much more than that at the time. I just thought, well, I'm not ready either yet, so I'll go and do a couple of years and see what happens. And
but whoever this biologist was, he obviously got an inkling that things were going to change.
I think, oh yes, I think so, because already on the science bases that were marine biology based, there were women down there, and there were still women doing summers on all the bases at that stage and on the ships. So it's just the wintering positions that I was interested in at Halley and Rotherhithe. And that they hadn't had women at that stage.
So you did your master's,
mm-hmm.
And then what happened?
I waited for 6 months knowing when the applications would come out and applied for the job and was very surprised to get it, but I couldn't wait.
What was the interview like?
Exciting, just very exciting to visit the BAS in Cambridge, the headquarters. Was special enough in a way, because, you know, as you walk down the corridors, there's lots of pictures of people doing things that you would love to be able to do. The interview was obviously, and I was pretty young, straight out of uni, so it was one of the first interviews that I'd sat, a panel of three. Questions were interesting, you know, they were showing me pictures, satellite pictures of weather. You had to kind of analyse the weather for them, and that was something that I was fascinated by at the time, so it was interesting and it kind of reminded me that this is what I want to do. And I was able to answer all the questions on where the bases are, and, you know, obviously I was interested in it, so I put a bit of research into it.
They were establishing you'd done your homework, have they?
Exactly. As in any interview.
Yeah. Do you remember who was on the other side of the table?
John Shanklin, who is one of the Met men in the 70s that discovered the Ozone Hole, and he was my boss in the future. Richard Hansen, who was personnel recruitment manager, and there would have been a base manager of some sort, but I can't remember which one it was.
So what actually were you applying for? Because you seem to have doubled in number of sciences by the time you got to Bath. So what were you going for in the end?
Meteorologist. But the position was actually advertised as meteorologist, physicist, electronic engineer. And the idea was that they actually wanted a team of three, preferably one of each of those disciplines. So my strength was obviously the meteorology at that stage.
And did you know which base you were applying for?
I knew there were openings at Rother and Halley, but I wanted Halley. Because Halley was where the science, to me, that's where the real science was going on at the time in my kind of discipline. So that's where I wanted to go.
Did they tell you straight away?
No, but it was only a day or two after that I got a phone call. And I think it was at that stage that up until then, it was pure excitement at the possibility of going south. And at that point, it was like, oh, this is going to be 2.5 years away from home. 2.5 years without friends. And I think the realisation, there was just a little bit of apprehension then. But it didn't last very long, and by the time you were getting to conference, it was just pure excitement again.
So. Did you get any sense at the interview that you were being sussed out psychologically? In retrospect, you might have a feeling about that now.
I think I was quite slow to grow up, so I probably wasn't aware of it, if it was going on. I remember being asked questions that I was expected to answer, things about, what is your home life situation? Who's going to miss you the most? Things like this, just kind of, I suppose they were leading questions, but I think I expected those kind of questions to be asked because it was a job, but it was also, quite a life change for a lot of people that were going down at that time, so.
What was the reaction back at home to the idea of our Vicky going away for 2.5 years?
Well, my parents still swear to this day that I only told them that it was for 18 months. when they found out it was 2.5 years, it was actually only about a month before I was going south. I think they were excited for me, but I think they were wondering if this was the right thing to do. I think my dad was probably expecting me to kind of go for a a more structured career, maybe, into perhaps a more professional discipline and stay in a discipline for the rest of my life, whereas I think I was...
There's that dilemma, isn't there? Will this interruption to my career path be good for me or bad for me?
Mm.
Did you worry about that?
No, because at the time, that was all I really wanted to do.
You were determined?
Absolutely. Yeah. That was not the next thing, the only thing on the list in terms of where I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. I didn't have any kind of longer-term goals than having a couple of years experiencing the Antarctic at the time.
Had you read about the Antarctic as a child? Or see? I mean, the old fids say, oh yes, I went to see Scott of the Antarctic with John Mills. Yeah. Did you have a similar moment?
I don't think I did. I mean, my first recollection, as I say, was the first dawning that this was a possibility was at university.
Mm.
I'd always been interested in space, as I mentioned earlier, and perhaps to a certain extent, the idea of living on a remote base with very few people, perhaps there's a link there in terms of, the fact that what an astronaut's doing up in a space lab. But in terms of kind of history and of the Antarctic, I really only got involved with that once I was down there and had the opportunity to read library books.
Looking back on it, do you think that the fact that you went to the convent school and therefore had a fairly enclosed life period of several years in an enclosed community was actually quite useful to the what was going to be required of you socially in the Antarctic?
I'd never thought about it, but quite possibly, because you are effectively living with a group of people of a similar age. I was going to say from all walks of life, but certainly not to the extreme that you get down in, on the Bass bases.
Hmm.
In fact, quite a lot of the girls were from military families similar to me. But you are living with them 24/7. You get to know everyone very well. You know the people you like and then you know the people you dislike, but you still find ways of living with them. So, yes, I think that probably did help. I hadn't really recognised that before.
Glad I could surprise you with one question. Yeah. So, what was it like when you got there? Was it what you hoped?
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant, magical place.
This is Halley, isn't it?
This is Halley, yeah. Just seeing the ice shelf when, as the boat was kind of sailing towards it. Absolutely fantastic and exciting. I think, I'm just trying to remember the moment. I think it was only in the second winter when I went down, well, I didn't actually go down to the ice shelf, but when everyone went down to the ice shelf to wave goodbye to the ship, and then you suddenly realise where you are and just how alone you are. But that first year, I think it was all so exciting that as we arrived on the ice shelf by ship, and then we were flown from N9 to the base. It's only about a 15-20 minute flight, but my first flight in a small aeroplane, effectively, and stuffed in the back and looking out the windows at the base that you're about to live in for 2 years. A very exciting moment.
Not many convent girls have that experience, do they?
Well, I think more and more these days, probably. So I'm glad to see. Yeah.
So how was it settling in? You were given a bunk.
I was, yeah. I was given a bunk room. I'm just trying to remember. Yeah, I was sharing with Kate, who was a lady that had wintered the year before me, Kate Charles. She was there were two ladies the winter before I joined, and they were the first ladies wintering at Halley. And Lucy, who I was taking over from.
Lucy Yeomans,
yeah. She'd done her first year and was actually quite involved with going out in the field and helping in other areas of Metz. So she was also moving over to Rotherham. So I didn't see much of Lucy. But Kate was the girl that I was going to be wintering with in my first winter. And I think perhaps the hardest thing of settling in was getting to know Kate. Because she'd obviously done her first winter. And as all winterers are, it's a bit like, oh, these strangers moving into my home. So you have to take things quite slowly with them. And it probably took all of the summer to become friends, I suppose, with Kate, who are now very, very good friends with and always have been after that winter. But I think I was surprised. I think I was used to with meeting girls in the past, you know, in that kind of situation where you're a minority, trying to make a strong bond with the girls that you do have around you. And that took a while with Kate, and that was probably the hardest thing about moving on to Halley. But in terms of settling in on the base life, like a duck to water, I think, I'd like to say. I don't know what other people would say, but yeah, I felt very comfortable, very quickly.
So Kate had been there the previous year?
She had,
And that was her first wintering women
that
year. Mm-hmm. Did you feel as though you were pioneering, although you weren't actually the front line of the infantry, you were the second line?
No, not
the female
really.
Infantry?
No. Perhaps they had done in the first year, but even then there had been women coming down for summers. I think I was just excited to be there, doing a job that I'd wanted to do for several years at that point. And no, it didn't.
So you weren't aware of the fact that you were at the forefront-ish of a sea change within the organisation that had resisted women for so long?
No, and I think perhaps that's in part due to the people that were surrounding me in that time at Halley and certainly back in Cambridge. I didn't have any awareness that there was any issues with introducing women down south for long periods. So it felt quite natural, I think, to me. Surprisingly, I suppose, when you say it now.
Just this thought that women were still on trial in your period, weren't they? I'm just supposing for a moment that there was still some resistance, psychological resistance, and there were some people in Bass who might have been waiting for the women to fail.
Yeah. I think, like I say, I think from kind of management and Cambridge side, I didn't feel any of that.
Nothing at all.
At all. But from the winterers side of things, and obviously I think we were just a new aspect to their wintering. There were guys that were coming out after 2 years that we met at conference when we were just about to go south. They'd obviously wintered 2 years with just the lads, and you know, when they first meet you and you're saying, oh, I'm going to Halley to winter, they are like, oh, right, that'll make a difference then, won't it? Be no more brawls over the bar and things, although maybe that didn't change so much. But so
you don't think you modified the male behaviour?
I think we probably did, yes, yeah, to a certain extent. But even when you got down there I think there wasn't so much resistance to you being down there. It was more a kind of excitement isn't the right word, but you could see the guys were interested in finding out why you wanted to be down there, you know.
You're a Nazi.
Why it appeals to you, yeah, yeah.
I don't quite know how to put this, but women were in short supply, weren't they?
Yes.
Did you have any problems?
There were two girls in my winter, in 16 of us in total, so... No, I didn't have any problems, but I was very lucky. I don't know if you know the background, but I met a chap, John Davies, on the way. He was wintering with us in that first year, and I'm still with him now, so...
So you formed a relationship on the base?
Yes, yeah.
Very wise.
Oh, it was a fantastic time, yeah.
Right, so that added to the magic of the experience.
I wouldn't have said I was wise about it. I think it was just a natural thing, but yeah, it worked out well for us.
Let's talk about your first winter then, doing the work you were doing. Tell me about your what work were you doing in more detail?
Meteorology, basically. So they call it operational met. It's not quite forecasting. At that stage, we didn't have any forecasters helping the pilots. But what we did was take weather obs every 6 hours in a team of three, so we worked different shifts. We launched weather balloons once a day. We took ozone measurements, sometimes over 20 times a day, depending on if it was sunny or not. Whenever it was sunny, you did a lot of measurements. And then on top of the kind of staples like that, then we also had quite a lot of research equipment. It was quite an interesting time at that stage for me. There was atmospheric chemistry was a growing science, so there's quite a lot of new kit going down for that. And then a lot of stable boundary layer research. So we got to fly kites with little sondes underneath them through the first 500 metres of the atmosphere, measuring variations in temperature and wind speeds and such like. And then we would send this data back to the scientists back in Cambridge, who would then ask for little tweaks in various experiments to help get the data that they're after. So it was much more operational than actual research at that stage.
And you had some special training before you headed south to,
yep.
So you knew what to do when you got there.
Yeah, we had...
Was that adequate?
Yes, I think it was adequate. It was adequate, yeah. We had training in taking weather observations, had training in the science kit that we were using down there. I mean, I was quite interested in the science, and I think perhaps that was a change from the past, in that the Met Man was quite often the person that wanted to go south but didn't have a particular trade that was wanted. So I think that they were trying to change that a little bit and get at least one out of the team of three going down as a Met Man to be Met trained before they got there. So I obviously had quite an interest in the science, and I think that helps the job to an extent that you can add a little bit for the researchers back in Cambridge.
To a layman like myself, can you explain the purpose or point of the work you were doing? How it fits into the grand picture?
Yeah, well, I think pretty much everyone is aware that the Antarctic Survey are looking at climate change. There's a lot of people taking ice cores that are telling us the history of 200,000 plus years ago and how the climate was changing then. Well, quite a lot of what we were doing was helping those records effectively. So not only were we just keeping normal Met records of how the weather was changing at the surface, but by looking at what was going on between the atmosphere and the snow surface itself, so both in the stable boundary layer and in the first kind of 5-10 metres of the snow, you can actually see how the current climate is transferring itself into the snow in the very first layers, and then slowly that will get compressed as more snow gets on top of it. So in future years, you can see how that ice core was affected by the atmosphere above it when it was on the surface.
We knew about global warming and the hole in the ozone layer before you went south.
Mm.
So was that actually one of the reasons why you wanted to do that kind of work?
It was, yes. I mean, certainly during my master's, I'd got very interested in climate change aspects. Mm. And the actual everyday Met. So, even when I came back from Bass, I was looking at joining the Met Office as a forecaster. That was quite high on my list of things that I'd quite like to try. So yes, I was kind of fully aware of the science that they were involved in, and was quite keen to get involved.
You're at the Bass, the Margaret Bay reunion,
yeah.
This weekend. So you are well aware of the guys who were there before you, and the meteorologists who were doing their obs 50 or 60 years before you.
Mm.
And it's that basis of work that allowed the Bass scientists 25 years ago to draw the conclusions they did, which led to the publication of the worries about global warming and the ozone layer. So what's it like meeting the guys who were this weekend who were down there doing the kind of what you're doing now?
It's been brilliant. I just wish it was lasting a week so I could actually talk to everyone, you know, and get the stories that I'd love to listen to. One night is definitely not enough.
Were you there on base at Halley? Were you aware of the ghosts of those men?
Yes, oh yes, you were, because, well, apart from the fact that every time you sat down in the dining room, there were pictures of all the winterers all around the walls looking at you. So, you know, it was something you often did, strangely enough. You would go and look at each picture and study the faces and things and the names underneath and think, what was it like then? But you start to realise, when you talk to the guys, how meticulous and methodical they were, without even... I don't know if they recognised at that stage how important the data would become in the future.
They didn't. They just they were just, as you say, it was an excuse to go south in many cases.
Yeah, yeah.
And then suddenly, half a century later, the work they did is now vitally important.
Absolutely. And, you know, given the situations that they were working in, you start to realise, even though they were enjoying themselves, I'm sure, as much as I did, how important it was that they actually started these records going 40, 50 years ago.
One of the big differences between their day and your day, and again between your day and now, is communications.
Mm.
I mean, they were doing 100 words a month.
Yeah.
Today you can pick up a phone and ring an extension and get Halley. What was it like in your day? In
96? Yeah, well, I saw quite a change, because even in 96 we had one A4 fax a week from family and 400 words on an email, I think it was. A week, I think. Might have even been a month, I can't remember. But even in the first two years that I did south, that changed quite rapidly. And obviously over the next few years, kind of going south repeatedly, it's a different world these days, and I think it's changed the base quite significantly.
So from year to year, you could measure the differences in communication.
Yeah.
As an aside, there's a guy who was here this weekend, a chap called George Kistrug, who was down there in the 60s, Fossil Bluff, late 60s. And he developed a technique whereby, rather like the Germans, you would run two or three words together.
Yeah.
So for your 100 words, you can actually get 300 words out.
Fantastic.
That kind of innovation that's going on.
Yeah. I think it's important that for the guys back home, before you go, you don't really realise it, but when you're south, you suddenly start thinking, please use the words that you've got to tell me everything you can, because you start to realise how important it is. And it's only when you get down that you realise you probably should have told your friends and family. It's actually really important that you stay in touch and let me know as much of what's going on as possible.
Were you... All right, you met somebody whilst you were at Halley, but were you lonely for the wider world?
No, I wasn't really. I think perhaps I'm just... I was used to moving into, you know, new groups of friends and absorbing myself in wherever I am. So I don't remember being lonely. I think the only time that I remember really wishing that I could get home was I'd had some bad news, and a housemate from university had died, and I wasn't able to get back to his funeral. And that for me was quite hard, and I did feel quite lonely then, obviously, because no one else knew him, so I can hardly go and talk about someone that no one knows. That was probably the hardest time.
It's interesting, in these interviews, how often that kind of thing comes up.
Yeah.
It's a common experience over the decades. Yeah.
Mm.
Did you get out much?
Get out much? Out of the base or out travelling in the field?
Yeah, travelling.
Not compared to the old boys. No dogs, no, just women, you know, that's an alternative. We had two trips a year, so one was a kind of 7-day and one was a 10-day trip where we'd take a GA out. And at Halley, it was a group of four people. We'd take a GA out. The GA would take us out, is probably more appropriate to say. Usually it was the GA and a new winterer and a second-year winterer and a new winterer, so you'd rope up in pairs. Usually it was someone more experienced in front of you if you were the first-year winterer. And if you were lucky, you would get down to the coastline, go and see the emperor penguins, explore Gin Bottle and the Rumpels, and also get in towards the chasms where the ice shelf meets the continent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we called it winter training trips. But for me, I'd never put on a pair of crampons before. I'd walked up a few hills, but even then, it wasn't a particular hobby of mine. So this was all really, really new to me, and very, very exciting. Total trust in the GA and their experience to get you out of places safely. And I think sometimes not really an awareness of just how dangerous things might have been, despite being roped up. You know, you can, your front man still can fall in a crevasse at any point. So,
did that happen?
Yes, it did, but not really falling. More kind of tripping in and maybe up to the thigh, rather than falling in deep crevasses, as you hear from some of the older boys that you've probably been interviewing more recently. But yes, you were always aware of what could happen at any stage, and depending on where you were travelling, you knew whether you were in a likely crevasse field area or not. So you just took extra precautions when you were there.
Were there any major scary moments?
Not really. I was trying to think of this before, and I think for me, the scary moment I developed myself, really, because I'd tripped and sprained my ankle when we were out in the field, in the Rumpels. In fact, I hadn't even... Yeah, I'd sprained an ankle. And then, obviously, in the process of getting back to the skidoos, I'd managed to hurt my other ankle and tear a ligament. So, you know, kind of stumbling back home, thinking, I've got to get myself out of here now. But it wasn't particularly scary. It was just an awareness of just how remote you are, and the fact that there is no alternative for you, just have to get yourself home.
You felt vulnerable.
Yeah, vulnerable. Yeah. But I think that's about the scariest moment we've had. So, yeah.
Okay. A lot of the reason for the British Antarctic Survey being in the Antarctic over the years has been the politics of being there.
Mm.
Did that ever cross your mind, that you were there for a political reason as well as a scientific reason?
Not so much in those first 2 years at Halley. Perhaps more when I did a winter at KEP, because of the... As a base commander at KEP, you also kind of sign yourself to be a magistrate of the Falklands and South Georgia government area. So South Georgia and South Sandwich Islands. So to an extent there, and with the history of South Georgia particularly, then you start to realise the kind of political side. But I think in those first 2 years at Halley, I wasn't particularly aware of that. No.
And all these trips, these field trips, that they were recreational, or were they serious?
They certainly had a serious side. I mean, I personally was thinking of them as a recreational opportunity, because you're getting out of base, seeing things that you've never seen before. But you were with a GA, and you were being trained every day with different techniques, including crevasse rescue. Just even simple things like, if you're falling down a snow slope with crampons on, how to get yourself out of trouble with ice axes and such like. So there were definitely kind of development opportunities there. And even in the process of travelling to where you were going, techniques of how to ride skidoos roped up, how to find, to follow a particular compass direction for 20 miles or so, how to put up a tent safely in the wind, so how to survive in a tent for a few days in a blow. So there were definitely training opportunities within it, but like I've said, I think at that age I just saw it as a recreational opportunity.
You didn't need to go travelling in order to do your job, though, did you? Met work?
No.
It was all based at the base?
It was, although the Met guys and some of the ionospheric scientists did have opportunities to travel in the summer when the scientists came down to visit. So there were certain summer projects that the scientists would need an assistant out in the field. Sometimes they were static in a tent in one place, and occasionally they were travelling. If they were static, they would often take a scientist with them. Otherwise, they'd take GAs, field GAs.
Sorry?
Field GAs. They take the mountaineers, basically the mountain leaders, with them as support. But occasionally, if you did have a static site, you would get scientists from the wintering scientists going out and joining the guys from Cambridge for a week or two out in the field. So it was useful to have training already in that.
Those photographs, black and white photographs of former FIDs on the wall, most of them, for them, the El Dorado, the promised land, was getting to the Shackleton Mountains, wasn't it? Was there any option for you to do that?
There was. I mean, that was the highlight of my first trip south, I think, was the chances a couple of times to sit in that co-pilot seat of a Twin Otter and fly around the Antarctic. I mean, that's special to anyone, I think. And I did get a chance to pick up some scientists from the Theron Mountains one season, and then in my middle season I had a day flying out to the Shackletons, picking up fuel drums. So we'd fly into a fuel dump site, dig out the drums, lift them up for another year so they would sit on the surface and slowly get buried again for the next year. Move on from there to a science site, pick up people in kit and bring them back to base. So it was brilliant days out in the field doing that. And again, the training that you have from your trips during the winter just make you feel more comfortable about going into those kind of remote areas. Mm. Yeah,
I know, because I've got the notes in front of me that was the beginning of a career, wasn't it?
New career. Well, it's only just starting, really, but yeah.
As a pilot?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Might come to that later on.
Okay.
Okay, so you did your first year, very successful. Everybody really thought quite a lot of you, really. So much so that you were then asked to be a base commander.
Yes.
Much to perhaps your own surprise.
Absolutely, to my own surprise. There were only four of us staying on for a second winter, so it was really limited for that, but yeah. They like to have a second year winter coming in as a base commander if they can. But yeah, I was still only 24, I think, maybe 25. So personally, I kind of felt that I was probably way too young to be doing it.
Did you have old people on base with you?
Yes, I did, actually. I mean, one of the guys that came down, Dave Routledge, who's a GA, had already wintered many times before and has since wintered many times since. And I think he was our oldest guy on station at the time, and I don't remember how old he was, but significantly older than me. And so, yeah, it was quite a decision to make. It wasn't like I was going to jump and say yes. I mean, I was willing to do it, but it was something that I was quite aware of. It was going to be quite tough, I think.
With just four people, it was still tough.
Oh, sorry, there were only four people staying on for the second winter.
Right.
So it was basically out of a choice of four of us, I suppose. And certain jobs, things like the radio officer, for instance, they don't often make radio officers BCs because they've got so much to do already. So there's only certain jobs that there's that capacity to be able to do more on top.
So how many people were under your commandership?
There were 16 again that winter, I think, yeah.
How did you cope?
I had a lot of support. I think it took about a month and a half, probably, in that winter, once we said goodbye to the ships, to kind of feel comfortable in the role. But I did have a lot of support from friends and from the new winters. I think it took a while for everyone to kind of get used to it. But eventually, I felt quite comfortable, and I'm very grateful for the support that I got.
Does this mean you're down in history as the first female base commander?
No, first female winter base commander. I think there's a lady called Maggie Eyre who was the first female base commander. I think she did a season at Bird Island.
At that point, did you have any sense of being a pioneer for your gender?
I was definitely aware at that point, yeah, because quite a few people were telling me, you know you're the first female winter base commander, don't you? So, yes, I think I was aware at that point.
So again, it was a good idea not to cock it up.
Yeah. I hope I didn't, but it was a tough year. I think for a lot of people, the second winters aren't as easy for various reasons. Perhaps because the first years are always so fantastic. You know, a lot of people have a great time in their first year south. And the second year, you've kind of seen things before. You've seen people make the same mistakes, or you're seeing people make the same mistakes that you made the first year. And it's quite a long time to be away from home. Plus some of your friends from the first year have left you. So you're in with a new group of people trying to kind of resettle into a new group. So I think generally speaking, second years are tougher than first.
Mm. You haven't got to answer this. Did your partner stay?
No, he didn't. So that was very tough.
So he came home?
Yeah.
How was that?
Very tough. But obviously in the long term, things have worked out well for us, so, yeah. The original decision, we were both supposed to be wintering for 2 years, but for various reasons he wasn't able to, so.
So you really were a bit exposed then when you took over command, when that ship sailed away two to three times.
Mm.
What sort of things were you having to do as base commander in the winter? I mean, the base is largely closed down, isn't it, in terms of operations? But
yes, well, there's certain things that you still have to prepare for the winter in terms of making sure you've got sufficient fuel above the ground stored on sledges to make sure that the fuel flippers can stay full throughout the winter. You've got things, again, it's all kind of managed by people in their own roles, but you've just got to oversee and make sure things happen at the right time of the year. So making sure the containers and the dump lines where we keep all our extra kit are all moved so that the snowdrifts don't build up too much throughout the year behind them. So there's quite a lot of just base tasks that need groups of people, not just one person in their own field doing it, but they need some assistance from other people. So you just have to time that and make sure the right people are available at the right time.
So you were administrating?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, but you had a lot of help from previous winter base commanders and from the base commander that had just left, you know, the guy that had come down for the summer to oversee the summer management. They give you a good full season of training, so you know what you've got to do.
So you had quite a lot of warning, did you? Yeah. You knew well in advance you were going to be taking over.
Yes, pretty much from the middle of the summer, I guess, we were kind of training up.
Traditional FID base managers would never ask anybody to do something they couldn't do themselves or weren't prepared to do themselves.
Mm.
Were you able to follow that tradition, or did you have to? Because did you find yourself having to ask people to do things you either wouldn't or couldn't do yourself?
I think I'd participated in pretty much every base task in the first winter. I mean, obviously, when you're kind of moving heavy fuel drums, sometimes you need two girls, sometimes you need a guy and a girl to do things. But certainly in terms of the strength that you need to do tasks, at that stage, even then, things were becoming so mechanical. You had so much mechanical assistance that there was really very little grafting in that respect.
So you're able to say, do as I do?
To a certain extent, but then things like working some of the vehicles, for instance, the cranes and what else do we have? Some of the D4, the bulldozers. Only certain people are trained up to do certain jobs. So, for instance, I could drive a bulldozer, but I couldn't drive the crane. So certain people were trained up for certain things, so you didn't ever have to do everything at that stage. So yes, I was asking people to do things that I couldn't do and that I wasn't able to operate a crane.
Yeah, well, they weren't things you were not willing to do. They were things
physically, definitely.
Technologically, you couldn't do them.
As far as I remember, I was willing to do absolutely anything.
Did you have to discipline anybody?
Yes.
Is it something you can talk about without naming?
Probably not.
Okay. Well, I won't ask you about the incident, but again, that was a challenge to you, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So how was that?
Very much so. I don't really get angry, and that was the first time that I've actually had to think, you know, this person needs to listen. I need to make them listen. And because they weren't listening, it was actually quite tough for me to, you know, I actually was getting angry inside, and that was quite unusual for me. Yeah.
Did you control your anger?
I did, yes. It was the first time that I've actually wanted to punch a wall. That's the only time, in fact, that I wanted to punch a wall, but I didn't.
Was there anybody you could talk to? Was there a deputy you could...
There was, yeah. And in actual fact, I just said to the chap at the time, you know, come back when you can speak properly to me and we'll deal with it then. But yes, I had a great deputy, Steve Layton, who was a sparky, an electrician, and he'd already wintered at Rotherer. And... He was a lad's lad as well, so he could always kind of deal with people in a completely different aspect to perhaps the way I was dealing as a winter BC.
So the one thing you couldn't do was lad to lad.
Yeah.
Relations.
It's kind of tough.
Yeah. Just backtracking slightly, had you actually had any man management training?
No.
From Bass or anybody else?
Oh, no, and that's something that has changed again these days. Guys that have been identified as kind of winter BCs generally get some training before they go down.
Mm.
Sorry, not as winter BCs. Certainly as BCs, they get training before they go down.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for talking about that. It's fine. We haven't finished yet, though. So the time came for you to actually leave Halley.
Mm.
You did two winters and then you came back to Britain, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
To settle down and never go south again.
Well, when I was watching the ice shelf go past in the distance as we were leaving Halley, I was thinking, I wonder if I will ever see this again. And At the time, I think I probably accepted that I wouldn't. But even when I got back to the UK, we sailed all the way back to the UK. By the time I got back to the UK, I was already thinking, is there a way in the future to get back? But I felt that that was enough at the time, that I should probably go and try and have a career in perhaps in the scientific discipline that I'd trained in already. So that was my intention when I
finally got back. So what went wrong with the master plan?
Well, I actually had a job up here in the lakes as an environmental scientist for a few years, using my MET background, looking at basically modelling and monitoring of pollution emissions from factories and such like, which was quite interesting from a scientific point of view. It was great, and living in the lakes was lovely. You can get out and go climbing in the evenings.
Mm-hmm.
Not helped by my partner still going south every year. So there was always this kind of urge to think, oh, well, I'd really like to do that again. And eventually after three or four years back in England, I just thought, well, okay, this BC job at KEP has been, I'd been, basically Les Whittemore, who's the base commander for KEP and Bird Island, had phoned me up a couple of times just to see if I was still interested in going south. And a couple of years I'd been saying, no, just keep phoning, but, you know, not this year. And eventually it was like, well, okay, this is it's time to go back.
So can you put your finger on what it was that turned the corner for you and changed your view from no, I won't to yes, I will?
I think perhaps I felt that I'd given the current job I was in sufficient time for me to kind of grow and develop within it. And even though I enjoyed it, it was nothing like the time that I'd had working down the Antarctic. And I think that, you know, kind of recognising that made me decide, well, I can. Mm. I'd like to go back. Yeah, there was nothing more major than that, I don't think. It was a slow realisation.
Didn't you have to apply, or were you handpicked?
No, I had a phone interview for the KPBC post, so I presume that there were four or five of us interviewed for the same post. That's the normal routine.
Yeah. Were you surprised when you got the positive response?
Was I surprised? I was pleased, but I was hopeful because, you know, I had had these phone calls every year or so.
Yes, I was
hoping that they were still willing to take me, even though I had been away for 3 or 4 years, which is probably the limit before people feel like you've lost touch with the system that's currently working down there.
You drop off the radar.
A little bit, yeah, I think so, yeah.
So what was it like? Obviously you weren't going to be as far south as you had previously, and perhaps the ice wasn't quite as thick.
No, certainly not, but there were lots of mountains.
South Georgia.
Oh, magical, beautiful place. I'd never seen mountains like that before. And I think a certain appeal for me was also that it was actually quite normal, which might sound a bit strange, but compared to the isolation and remoteness of Halley, the community that we're living in South Georgia, it wasn't just Bass guys. So there was a Bass team of 9 of us, but there were also 2 couples. And then in the summer months, there was, like, the Morrison construction team were coming in to clean up the Vic and Whaling station. So it was like a little community. And to me, that seemed much more normal living circumstances than the challenges of living with one small group at Halley. So that was very different for me. And the fact that you can get up in the mountains and have a walk and ski every day, that was fantastic.
And you're a base commander at South Georgia?
I was, yes.
For the year or for the summer?
Well, they only have one base commander. You're basically based down there for the full year as a base commander. But yeah, so you're winter and summer base commander.
How was it, being a base commander, all the time?
That was fine. I didn't find that a problem. I guess I'd matured a fair bit more at that stage, and I knew what I was letting myself in for. It was a great job. I really enjoyed it.
So was your MET work still a pertinent at that point, or were you now doing something different?
No, it was a base commander role, so you were kind of fully established in the management roles, really. To a certain extent, we did have some MET equipment, so I would, and no MET man specifically there, but the MET equipment was all pretty much automatic, so occasionally we'd try and fix things when they went wrong. But beyond that, it was more assisting with the comms, because we didn't have a comms manager, so you were kind of trying to keep the IT side of things up and running and the radio side of things. So that was the kind of added on role to the management role. And a lot of boating. That was the kind of new experience for me. And I'd done a little bit of sailing when I was a kid, but got a chance to go and work with the Ribs when we were out there. So did a lot of
the
work
Ribs.
On the boat. Yep, they're 5.5 metre inflatable, which is inflatable.
Was that boating with a purpose, or was that again recreational?
Both. It was the boats were there for business, basically. So we were taking the fisheries officer effectively over to the fishing ships for inspections and release, so that the fishing ships could then go and fish in the local waters. And they weren't using their own small boats, so we would take the fisheries officer from the base to the ships. We did have boating officers down there, but obviously they needed crew. And so everyone on base was trained up to crew for the boats, and a few extra helm guys were trained up as well.
And then he went for 3 summers to Bird Island as base commander.
Yes.
That was your five base commander posts then.
I guess,
one
yes.
at Halley, one at
yes.
South Georgia, and 3 at Bird Island.
That was when I started coming back to the UK for the UK summers, planning for the next season. Analysing, you know, the last season and planning for the next season, and then going down there for the Southern Hemisphere summers.
So you were being employed by Bass 12 months a year
by
that time?
Yeah.
Yeah, working at Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Tell me about Bird Island, what sort of things you were doing there. I know this is just a thumbnail sketch, but what stands out?
To me, it was like Jurassic Park. If South Georgia was, what's that film from The Hobbit?
Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, yeah. The scenery at South Georgia was kind of Lord of the Rings territory, whereas when you went to Bird Island, suddenly you got these strange animals everywhere, and it was more full of kind of green mosses and ferns and tussock grass. It was a very strange place initially, because I had no background in biology at all, and I was surrounded by zoologists whose every waking hour was involved working with animals. Which was very, very new to me. But they obviously loved this place, and you could see that everyone created a very special bond with the island. And anyone who spent any time there, I think, creates exactly that bond. And what an opportunity, you know, someone who never had, not an interest in animals. I've always wanted pets, although I never actually had any when I was a kid, to suddenly kind of be involved helping scientists every day, walking around albatross and fur seal colonies is quite amazing. It really is quite mind-blowing the first few times, and then suddenly you start getting used to it after a couple of seasons, and I don't think you ever take that place for granted. But everyone you talk to, I'm sure, that has been to Bird Island will remember it as a very, very spectacular place. Mm. Yeah.
And because you've had such a long career with Bass, we have to go on. In 2006 you were, if you like, deputy manager or deputy base commander at Rotherham.
Station support manager,
Am I right thinking that's kind of vaguely deputy? Or
There's a few different managers under the base commander, so we all kind of run different areas.
One of the deputies.
Yeah.
And how was that?
Quite an easy season.
Okay.
Sounds a bit cheeky, but I think in a way I was hoping for the Halley BC in the future, so this was a perfect kind of growth season for me, because I'd only been managing a small base, mostly full of scientists who I felt quite an affinity with, to move into a big base like Rotherham and see, I got a chance to see how a big base manager was running their base as well, so that was quite a good opportunity. And in terms of the job itself, it was very much admin, which was relatively easy, I guess, at that stage. So another opportunity to go and sit in a co-pilot seat that season. And that was when I started thinking in the long term, you know, this really could be something that I'd like to do in the future, long-term future. But yeah, it was a great season. I enjoyed it. It was quite different from the other bases because of the large community. In the summer, you've got over 100 people there, really.
So was it, in fact, instead of being one community, was it several communities in the same building?
Definitely, yeah. I did see that quite a lot. Particularly, you know, I think the science community were quite strong there. and the maybe this kind of summering construction teams, so usually quite a tight-knit bunch. But everyone seemed to kind of merge quite well. You know, there were a lot of well-organised kind of night social events. So there was a great band on station for the season, so we had a couple of really good band nights. And they have a thing called the Folk Night. I think it's called the Folk Night, where everyone does lots of different sketches. Absolutely hysterical night, and I've got very fond memories of the social events from that season.
I presume you were watching the then base commander a bit like a hawk, trying to pick up tips.
Yeah.
What were you learning about your future responsibilities as a base commander?
How to be calm. it was Steve Hind who was the base commander at the time down there. I think he'd only done a couple of seasons at that stage, but he had obviously already earned the respect of everyone and listened to everyone. So, you know, during his kind of weekly meetings with other managers, he would make sure that he was aware of what everyone else was wanting to say or what they thought the issues of the week were. It was a great opportunity to learn from him.
Which came in handy when you went back to Halle. And you did two summers at Halle, 2000.
Just one. It was one summer, 07, 08.
Oh, right.
The first construction season, of a
This is a new build, the one that's still going on.
Yeah. So I came back to the UK and almost immediately kind of moved into that role, really.
Did you know that was going to happen when you finished?
No, I didn't know. I think I was hoping it would. but it was only maybe 2 or 3 months before, 3 months maybe before we went south that season that started moving into that role. Over that summer, starting to meet all the construction team managers that were involved and the Halle 6 project managers from Bass. So everything was already rolling by the time I kind of got involved. And it was purely taking over the role from Pat McGoldrick, who was the Halle BC before me, in the last few months. Yeah, exciting times.
By this time, was the fact that you're a woman completely relevant?
I felt it was. I'm not sure if everyone else did, but yeah, I think throughout the career with Bass, I've been quite lucky in that I've never had anyone make it obvious to me that there's any issues. So yeah,
great. Yeah. So tell me about this. I mean, building a new base, even in the old days, was a pretty hectic experience, and building a new high tech base at the Halle, which was hopefully the base to end all bases, which would not be sunk under the snow in 10 weeks.
Well, it was exciting. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the Halle 6 kind of video.
I've seen the model at Bass.
And the model, yeah. I mean,
the listeners may not have done, so please don't. Please do describe it.
It's a very iconic building that they're aiming for with a completely new design. So it's 7 capsules and a main capsule for living accommodation built on skis with hydraulic legs. So the idea is that you can actually move this in the future. Inland as the ice shelf starts moving out, then you can reposition your base in the future, which is completely novel. It looks very modern, and it is a massive project. I think that the main difference from the Halle 6 project from previous Halle builds is that, well, I'm not aware exactly of the number of management that was involved with the previous builds, but certainly when I moved into the base commander role, I think perhaps the base commander plays a different role these days than it did in the past, in that you have a Halle 6 project team, you have a construction subcontractors, basically, management team, you have a logistics manager for the base, you've obviously got your flight ops and operations managers. So there's a massive kind of structure of management that have been involved with this project for years before I got involved with it. I was very much kind of coming into it at the last minute. But it felt very exciting, and everyone was excited by the fact that this was going to be a big year. Even before we got down, we knew we weren't going to be taking the whole structure down that year. It was purely a kind of first start trial, in a way, to get the first couple of modules up and built and see how they fared over a winter. So, yeah, it was exciting times.
But as the base commander,
yeah,
how much did you have to do with the new building? Because, in fact, all that was being done by people who again had expert knowledge beyond your remit.
Yeah, I think in terms of actually the structure of the building, not a great deal, but what the involvement was is making sure that the current base ran as it should. The science, as much as we were still trying to achieve, was being achieved. that everyone was getting fed and watered. I mean, it sounds basic, but, you know, that everyone has a bed for the night, and they're getting fed and watered. And making sure that there aren't any massive problems between the different teams, because I think there was quite high potential, and there had been problems in the past with construction teams coming in. We had guys from South Africa, 40-odd people from South Africa, who'd never been south before, coming in to help with the Morrison team. And I think it was mostly trying to make sure that everyone gelled to achieve the maximum that we could from the season. Yeah.
So you had over 100 people in your consciousness?
We did, yes.
You did? Overall.
Well, yes.
For special member?
Yes, yeah. But I think even then, you know, every night there were maybe six or seven of us sitting at a management table trying to decide what needed to be done the next day, who needed which vehicles, who needed assistance from other people. So it was a big team effort, and it certainly felt like that all the way through the season. Yeah.
Do you get much time off?
Not in that season, no. Well, even actually, in fact, as a base commander, you don't really get a lot of time off. I mean, your time off, I remember at Bird Island particularly, time off was when you were going to help the scientists. You know, you got to walk up the hill and a chance to kind of look at the animals, and that was what I considered time off. That last season at Halley, I got, 2 days off that I remember, where I actually kind of got out in the field. But I think for, not just for the management, it was for everyone, it was a very tough working season. You know, you're still working 12 hours a day, with a few hours either side, just to kind of, as required, when people have questions to ask you at the end of the day.
Why didn't you go back in 2008/9?
Because I think at that stage I decided that I wanted to fly. The last couple of summers before that, I'd been doing a private pilot licence, and it suddenly seemed an achievable thing to do, that I could actually go and get a commercial licence. So it was a tough decision, especially having joined the Halley 6 project, effectively.
But
I would have liked it, no, and I could see that was going to take another 3 or 4 years, and so I should either leave then or finish the project, rather than kind of staying halfway through, I think. And even though I'm still interested in how it's going now, I've made the decision and I've kind of jumped ship, so to speak, and moved on. Yeah.
So what's the next episode in your life?
Well, I've qualified now as a commercial pilot. It's 2 years since I left Bass, and just got my first flying job. So hopefully next week I'll be taking passengers for the first time.
With who?
With Flybe.
From where to where?
My first flight's Manchester to Belfast and back. Yeah.
As a co-pilot?
As a co-pilot, yeah. Oh, yeah. You spend 4 or 5 years sitting in the co-pilot seat before you become the captain, so first officer.
You're going to have to wear a uniform, Vicky.
And iron shirts. not a very bad thing to do, is ironing your uniform before you go to work. Yeah, it's quite a different life.
you've been chatting to the veteran FIDC this weekend, and we both realised how loyal they felt towards FIDS. There was a great sense of, because of the conditions they were working in, they were wintering, they were out of touch with the rest of the world, they were pioneering. There was a great sense of loyalty to each other and to FIDS as an organisation.
Mm.
Was that the case with you and Bass?
The loyalty? Mm. Absolutely. Yes, even it was very hard to leave when I did, because I felt like I was letting them down, having thought that I would be doing the Halley 6 project for a few years. Definitely felt like I was letting them down. But then you do recognise there's always people that feel the same loyalty that you do, that are just kind of waiting to have the chance to do the same thing that you've done. So it's I don't think they're ever kind of struggling for people to work with them in the long term. It's something that once you've had that kind of chance to winter, I think a lot of people might feel that they would like to kind of give back something to Bass as a whole. And certainly the way that I felt it was, particularly in the Girton conference, you felt like you were trying to kind of instill the same excitement that you had when you first went down. And as when you're working as a base commander, you get that opportunity to describe a base in 5 minutes or 10 minutes, however long you have, and just try and kind of get people excited about what's coming up for them. So, yeah, there is definitely a loyalty there. Yeah.
Good luck with the new career.
Thank you very much.
Try not to turn the plane south by mistake. Thank you.
Thank you very much.